And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Hello listeners, sorry to interrupt your show, but we've got a small favour to ask. We're currently doing a bit of a survey to find out more about you, your podcast listening habits, and the sort of adverts that are most relevant to you. If you feel like helping, please head to surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. That's pretty catchy, so I'll say it one more time. surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. Thank you.
Totally Football Show. Today, Champions League, and now their watch is ended. Ronaldo ensuring Piers wasn't the only man making a red-faced early exit on Tuesday. Wednesday, Messi following suit. We look back on a dramatic midweek with Liverpool, Haaland and more. And then ahead to a big weekend in the Premier League. Moyes and West Ham at Man United and the North London Derby. Will Kane hit a screamer? And is there any way to talk about Alex Lacazette? Much to discuss in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Warmest of welcomes to you, listener. It's Thursday the 11th of March. And with us we've got Karen Carney. Hello, Karen.
Hello, you all right?
I'm very well, thank you. Karen Carney, MBE, of course. Sasha Gurionov is also on board. Hello, Sash.
Morning, James.
Fresh from taking the bins out and staring at a wall for 2 hours. More on that shortly. Duncan Alexander completing the trio.
Hello.
Hello. Do you know what's special about Thursday the 11th of March?
No.
Go on, Sash.
It's exactly a year since Liverpool got knocked out by Atletico Madrid.
Wow, that's interesting. And it's a year minus one from the day football was suspended. Thursday the 12th of March 2020. When, do you remember, late on that evening, Arteta's positive COVID test led then to the Premier League deciding to suspend the weekend's fixtures and ultimately lock down for the country, which otherwise had been sailing merrily onwards. Crikey. How different things were back then. That week in 2020, Man United had just beaten Man City 2-0 and Chelsea had just taken Everton apart at Stamford Bridge. Curious, no?
That was funny. We was at the bridge the other day and that fixture happened, didn't it? Mm. And I was with Peter Drury and he was like, did you see the betting odds were still there from that game last year? And there was obviously players on there that weren't at both teams.
This was the kind of info up for the spectators at Stamford Bridge that had just been left there a year on.
Yeah, so you could obviously go and place your bets for that final game. That was the last game, I think, at the bridge before the lockdown. And it was the exact same fixture. So we walked up and it was like first goal scorer for either team. But there was a couple of players that have obviously moved on from both sides. But it was quite weird.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, like when they go down with those subs to the Titanic and they find menus and stuff.
There must be offices all across the country with stuff on whiteboards that's just paused and will never get enacted.
Totally Towers, very much. Yeah.
It's a bit like a Pripyat in Chernobyl, you know, frozen in time for 40 years.
Tell you one thing that was different about this week in March, Sasha, and that's the fact that Liverpool didn't get knocked out of the Champions League. I'm delighted to reveal to you. Let's have a quick check on the Champions League results before we get our teeth into them. A Tuesday... they think it's Oliveira. It is now, as Sergio's free kick sealed. An epic clash between Porto and Juventus. 4-4 on aggregate. Porto threw on away goals. Meanwhile, late drama for Dortmund after that Sevilla comeback from 2-0 down, which almost forced extra time. Haaland's brace and VAR meddling with the kind of space and time fabric. The other highlights there. On Wednesday, Barcelona's campaign ended in a 1-1 draw at Paris Saint-Germain. The Parisians winning thus 5-2 on aggregate. And Liverpool added another two goals to win their tie with RB Leipzig 4-0 across the two legs. All this means that for the first time since 2004-05, neither Lionel Messi nor Cristiano Ronaldo will be in the Champions League quarterfinals. But plenty of exciting players will. And we certainly had two great games a midweek. You might have enjoyed all four, I don't know. But two really stood out. One was Porto on Tuesday against Juventus, that marathon affair in Turin. And the other one was Wednesday's PSG Barcelona. So this was potentially Messi's last game for Barcelona. Obviously, there's major question marks over that. What do you think he will feel about it?
I think he would love to strangle Dembele for missing, I don't know, six, seven chances in the first half. They kept on opening up PSG's, right flank. And he went with his left, he went with his right, he shot across the keeper, he cut inside, and he missed them all. It was absolutely extraordinary. I think the first half performance from Barcelona was really powerful, and I think both wings worked really well. But all those misses were glaring, and of course Messi then misses a penalty as well. And for the second half, Barcelona just don't have it anymore. But I thought the first half performance from Barcelona was probably one of the best halves of football by a team we've seen, you know, in a number of years, I think.
They were looking for another remontada, of course. And Daniel Story pointing out that in the first half alone, they had the same number of shots as in that 6-1 in 2017. As you say, though, unfortunately, most of them fell to Dembele.
Yeah, 16 shots in the first half, 9 on target, 90% pass completion. It was kind of like the last great hurrah for Barcelona under Messi. And it could have gone differently, you know. As Sasha said, with better finishing, they could have been 2 or 3 up at half-time, and that would have, you know, scared PSG, I imagine. I mean, obviously, Messi came out with a lot of credit, and his goal was, you know, he hit that so hard that the rage that went into it almost deformed the ball, but then he missed a penalty. Only Sergio Aguero has missed as many penalties in the Champions League since 2003-04 as Messi. You know, obviously, Ronaldo also gets tagged Penaldo on social media for taking a lot of penalties, but you know, Ronaldo's taken 22 in the Champions League. Messi's taken 20, so it's not like Ronaldo has loads more. It's just he's sort of better at finishing them.
Mm. That was an extraordinary strike. Joe Cole in the BT Sports studio saying he put violence on that ball. Had he scored just before half-time, or equally, if Anthony Taylor and VAR hadn't given that questionable penalty against Barcelona, we might have seen it in the second half, do you think?
Well, given PSG's past form for collapsing, and given their, I would say, quite a cowardly approach to this game as well, perhaps with those collapses in their mind, I think second half would have been on had he scored that penalty. I do have to say that both penalties were really weird. I think, obviously, for the PSG penalty, I think everyone agrees, you know, the player isn't getting, Icardi isn't getting there. But for the Barcelona penalty just before half-time, you know, both players are kicking at the ball, which is up in the air. I don't think it was a penalty at all either. So it's a couple of obviously strange decisions. But I think that missed penalty, if anything, just really broke Barcelona psychologically.
I mean, they were still there in the second half, but as Duncan memorably put it, every Barcelona corner looked like they had 11 goalkeepers up in the 93rd minute.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of all yellow away kits. I think that should be banned from football. It doesn't look right. But yeah, they had one shot on target in the second half, and it did sort of peter out. And you know, from the 70th minute on, really, it didn't. The commentators were like, you know, they in the famous remontada, you know, the goals came really, really late, but it just never felt like that. And you know, I don't completely buy that this is Messi's last Champions League appearance for Barcelona. I can see him signing another 1 or 2 year contract and being back next season. But it does feel like, the last real chance that he might have to win the Champions League. I mean, we pointed out before a few weeks ago, he hasn't won the Champions League since he was 27. And if you'd have said that at the time, that would have been his final one, people would have laughed. But that happens in football. If you'd have said to an Arsenal fan in 2004, you won't win the league again for many decades, possibly, they would have laughed as well. So, you know, you never know when a full stop comes in football. You can only tell in retrospect. And it's increasingly looking like that was it for Messi.
In life, Duncan. In life. Mm. Mm. You were calling PSG cowardly, Sasha, for their approach. I mean, it must be difficult, though, to know how to approach a 4-1 lead, Karen.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. But you know the team you're up against, you've been there before. You've just got to be defensively organised and hard to beat. And I think that it's always the first goals are most important in that type of instance. So, look, it wasn't, I'm sure, the best of performances that they would have liked. But at the end of the day, it's a results-orientated business and they're in the next round, which is the most important thing for them.
Absolutely. One other thing. Did you notice that a Paris Saint-Germain fan was arrested by police at 5 a.m. at the Barcelona team hotel after setting off the fire alarm? You don't think it was...
I think it was,
Anyway, all right. Well, that's Barcelona. Sasha?
I enjoyed the front page of L'Equipe today. Le Messi, c'est Navas. Because I think Keylor Navas really did have a phenomenal half of football there. So I think if anyone kept PSG in the game, there's probably the goalkeeper.
PSG through to the quarterfinals. Tuesday, meanwhile, the big upset, although it kind of wasn't, was Porto putting Juventus out. Juve actually winning 3-2 on the night, but it was 4-4 on aggregate. And Porto going through on away goals despite playing for over an hour with 10 men. Now, this result was 17 years to the day that Mourinho's Porto went through at Old Trafford. How far could this Porto go?
Well, I don't want to be captain, let's wait for the draw, but we should probably wait for the draw, shouldn't we? I mean, the form Pepe showed was incredible for a man of his age. And he, obviously, over the years, he's got a reputation of as a bit of a cartoon villain, but his defending there was... It reminded me of a sort of veteran defender in an FA Cup tie against the top flight team, just, you know, chucking himself in front of everything. And, you know, it was amusing because you could see how it was winding Ronaldo up more and more as the game went on. I think there's not a metric for gesticulating during games, but I think Ronaldo might have broken it in that match. You know, a couple of times Morata or Chiesa were caught offside, and you're right, he's immediately drawn to Ronaldo at the bottom of the screen, just kind of violently turning away. And, you know, you can understand his frustration. He moved to Juve to win the Champions League, and that's not going to happen.
Well, you can imagine Juve's frustration with Ronaldo equally. That's a topic we'll come on to in a second. But, yes, all hail 38-year-old Pepe. What a player, always loved him. And Porto in general, Conceição has now taken them into the quarterfinals twice in 3 years, which, given that they sell all the players because they've got no money...
Yeah, well, it's not even like they're a team full of young talent. So this was, I think, their second oldest starting 11 they'd ever put out in the Champions League, which obviously is slightly bolstered by Pepe. But, you know, they're an effective team rather than a kind of, you know, team of glittering talents that's going to be picked off necessarily. So, yeah, I mean, this is the joy of cup football. This is what, you know, knockout football's about. And I'm sure everyone across Europe's big clubs shares that opinion. So that's what we enjoy.
I think, though, you spoke about how the age inside is, but that's experience. And you saw with Pepe, you know, you don't have to get in foot races. You don't have to get into certain situations. You just use your game intelligence. And he used it in abundance, and so did the team, to be fair. And, you know, you can't buy that experience. You can have young players who run around really energetic, and sometimes that's the way to go forward. But there is, I've always said, there's formulas to winning games, especially in competitions. And to be fair, the more experienced you are, the more it is easier to kind of understand that formula. And Pepe was immense in that, and so were the rest of the team and the manager and his tactics. Fair play to them.
I think also one factor in this game was the fact there was, I think, a bit of desperation because they had to go through to save their season. They're miles adrift in the Portuguese league. They just got knocked out of the cup as well, played quite badly against Braga. And I mean, at the weekend, they had a bit of a training game where Sergio Oliveira, the midfielder, also scored a long ranger. And I think this is like going back to experience as well. I mean, you got guys like Marchesin, who is in Europe for the first time with Porto. I mean, he's in his 30s. Obviously, you have Pepe, whose challenge on Chiesa when Chiesa was facing open goal is just one of the best things I've seen in years. But in the middle, you have Sergio Oliveira, who's 28, and he's been at Porto, I think, for over 10 years, but he's been out on loan. But he's having the season of his life. He's got 17 goals this season. I think the most he's managed previously was about 6 or something. So he's finally having his breakout season at the age of 28. And then up top, I thought this is a situation where one striker gets sent off and the other striker does two strikers work, and then you really have to be a bit of a hero to step for that. And I thought Marega run everything up top for over 100 minutes, like absolutely magnificently. So I think everybody in that team really did a fantastic job, really played at the limit. Can they do it again, I think, is the question.
Sometimes it's easier though when you do go down to a 10. As a former player, sometimes it's a lot easier because you then actually just retreat and your tactics are pretty much, it's all on them then. And sometimes it is a lot easier to go, we just bank up, we just go, a 4-5 or a 4-4-1 or whatever it is, it's sometimes it's a lot easier. And like I said, credit to them. It was a brilliant, dogged performance. And but you're right, it's now when you're 11v11, have they got the quality? Have they got the players to really then go and get a result? Because it's easy, like I said, to defend and hit on counters and set plays. But, you know, it's 11v11. You've got to go for a team at some point.
The thing is, also in this game, they didn't just have to defend, because after Chiesa had scored his second, that then sent the whole thing to extra time. And then you had probably the key moment, which was the free kick. So Rabiot immediately had that header. Well, I say immediately, like 3 minutes afterwards, but that free kick left Juve needing two with only a couple of minutes left to play. Had they just had the draft excluder, which we've seen mocked on free kicks, the player lying down behind the wall, that never would have happened. Equally, if one of those players in the wall had not been Cristiano Ronaldo, it never would have happened.
He did sort of turn away and, you know,
open his legs.
Open his legs, yeah. It wasn't the most solid wall technique.
Well, that's,
I've seen.
He's getting pelters for it in Italy. Aklav Hanif saying, interested to know what the reaction has been in Turin, specifically on Ronaldo, after this. And it's not positive. Of the three sporting papers, two to Sport, the one most closely aligned with Juventus, has kind of stopped short of pinning it on him. But Corriere dello Sport, based in Rome, went with betrayed by Ronaldo. And Gazzetta yesterday and today very much talking about how he's been a disappointment.
I mean, obviously, you know, in Rome, with the heritage from Hadrian, you know, a badly constructed wall is awful. So I can see why there's so much anger.
Thanks for bringing that up. So, yeah, so the kind of general fallout seems to be that they want to stay with Pirlo. They actually want to continue with his project. But they do recognise that his project and Ronaldo are not necessarily two compatible things. Had, for example, as the Gazzetta was suggesting today, Ronaldo been operating in a simple 4-4-2 like Ranieri would do, they probably would have been fine. But what Pirlo wants to do and the level of expenditure they've got at their disposal after blowing, what is it, 80 million euros, I think, a year, 50 million of wages alone on Ronaldo per season, it kind of mean they've got a choice. But I think he would like to move on after this season, and I think they would probably like it too. But whether they'll find anybody to take over his wages with 1 year left on his contract in Turin remains to be seen. Certainly, I think everyone was really upset to see Juve knocked out by Porto just 24 hours after Andrea Agnelli had unveiled his bright idea for reforming the Champions League. He does actually say this wasn't his idea. It was Edwin van der Sar, but he was just presenting it in, you know, as chairman of the European Clubs Association.
That old excuse.
Yeah.
I've used that
later. Former Juventus player as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. So, I mean, there's been a lot of fuss about this. We get a lot of fuss about Champions League proposals at least once a season. Are you more, less, same concerned about this one?
Well, I'm not concerned in the sense that it seems like every year now we get these proposals that, you know, because it's countering potential Super Leagues and but if it does happen, I would be, I mean, you know, to make it so skewed towards the big clubs would remove the drama from the competition. You know, the last, I would say, what, 3-4 years, the quarterfinals and semi-finals of the Champions League have been some of the best football I think anyone's ever seen. The drama, the comebacks, the quality of football, the kind of the players head-to-head. I don't think you need to do this to, you know, ensure big, great games involving the world's best players. But
how does Van der Sar's plan, which they say could be ready to come in from 2024, how does that change all that?
Well, it expands the competition into much more of a league. So you're removing a lot of the knockout element of it. And, you know, leagues, we've seen it in other competitions. You know, the group stages aren't great, and but having a massive group stage is not going to help the competition. But what it does help is big clubs' bottom lines, because they get guaranteed games every season, and then they're starting to base stuff on, you know, heritage and history and stuff. And it's just, you know, the European Cup / Champions League, I think, was improved by turning it into its modern format. And if you remember, the two group stage era was widely detested, and they got rid of that, brought back the last 16, and it hasn't changed since 2003 or 2004. Ironically, that was the season Porto then went on and won it, the first time in the current format. And I think this works. I think this is, for fans, I think this is a good compromise between, you know, a a competition where the big clubs have a semi-guarantee of a certain amount of games, but there's still the knockout drama at the end of the season. And the balance, if you shift that balance, it's going to really affect everything.
All right.
And also my head explodes from this Swiss format where you have a league of 30-odd teams and they only play 10 games each and then you rank them. Mm. And then how you set the... I think the way you can set those games... I think that's not, I wouldn't like to call it fiddleable, but it's like how the algorithm to determine that, I think, can be gamed. Skewed. Yeah.
All right. His other proposals for making the last 15 minutes of matches subscription-based and big clubs not selling to each other were, on the other hand, completely brilliant. Very good. Much more from the Champions League to discuss. A Dortmund performance against Sevilla with Erling Haaland and, of course, Liverpool up next.
And they're off. The plucky youngster on the inside has started fast. Number 7 now, going down the outside. The big fella in the middle is racing to make up the ground. A late charge and across the line. Yes, the ball is across the line. Excellent header from the big fella. To celebrate an unbelievable week of racing and football, get a completely free £5 bet on Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday of Cheltenham and a £5 risk-free bet builder on Chelsea v Atletico Madrid. Paddy Power.
Max 1, £5 free bet per customer per day. Racing free bets available 48 hours before first race each day. Pre-match bet builder bets only. Minimum legs 2 plus. Max cash refund £5 if it loses. T's and C's apply. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Tuesday in the Champions League, Dortmund underlining just how dangerous a 2-0 lead can be. Getting pegged back by Sevilla to a 2-2 scoreline, but still going through 5-4 on aggregate. VAR caused plenty of comment in this one. A very weird spell in the middle of the game, but the big story... Erling Haaland, once again, a brace here. He's now on 20 Champions League goals in 14 matches. Can anyone put this into perspective for us?
Yes.
Yeah.
He's the fastest player to reach 20 goals in the Champions League. He's done it 10 games quicker than the previous record holder, which was Harry Kane, who's a reasonably good player himself. Wow. Haaland's, like, every time you watch him, it's terrifying. We've said it many times on here, but he is a robot footballer who's come to destroy the game in terms of records. He's so good.
Karen, have you ever seen anything like Haaland before?
No, I mean, when he barged that player, the player tried to barge him and he just, like, running through, and it was just as if to say, we used to call it in football, get on the weights, and he just bounced off him. And I've never seen that in terms of speed and power and movement, and he's got everything. And look, I don't agree with what he did going up to the goalkeeper, but then part of me thinks I quite like that because it's personality.
Yeah, I like that.
I'm like, it is a personality. It shows passion. It shows a bit of ego, which I really admire, because when you're on the pitch, you're an actor or an actress and you've got to perform, and I like that. And I just think it just shows a lot about him. And Duncan's itching to get in, so I'll let you speak.
Yeah, I mean, Bono had done it to him a little bit, so I think a bit of back and forth. I mean, you know, Thierry Henry did it to Chris Kirkland and didn't harm his reputation, so, you know. It just occurred to me, actually, that, you know, people talk about, you know, genes in football and stuff, and there's a guy in pro cycling at the moment, Mathieu van der Poel, who's kind of a similar build to Haaland, and he's absolutely dominating the sport at the moment.
In the mountains especially, I imagine.
Well, not in the mountains, but he's kind of redefining what a cyclist can do. And his dad, Adrie, was a really famous pro, and his granddad was Raymond Poulidor, who's one of the all-time famous names in cycling. And obviously, Haaland's dad is a professional footballer, and it's like, you know, the genes have combined to create these kind of super sportsmen of the 2020s. And who's next? Sergio Aguero's son, maybe? Because obviously his granddad is Maradona. So it's the way forward.
Yeah. By the way... Haaland's got a cousin. His name is Albert Brautchaland. He's age 17. He plays for Mulder's youth team, much as Haaland used to. He scored 64 goals in 37 games. Woof.
Here we go. See?
Norway. They're coming for you.
I'm just going to say that I'm really sometimes worried for Marco Reus when Holland lifts him, throws him, hugs him, because it's like Holland's like this massive child who doesn't know his own power. And I think maybe he's just going to break his bones a little bit at some point. I totally agree with everything that was said about Holland. Just so impressive and so unusual and so frightening. But at the same time, probably moving on to the next point, he's really badly let down by his defense. I look at this Dortmund team and it's like a colossus with feet of clay. Like going forward, they are so good. And then with half an hour to go, Sevilla put on Luke de Jong. They start like just chucking crosses into the box. And this has been Dortmund's problem for years. It's like a grenade goes off and instead of attacking, they all kind of sort of seem to run away from it. And this is how they conceded the goal in Seville, and they nearly cocked it up on Tuesday as well, because they just can't defend.
That would be my policy with a grenade as well, Karen.
No, I was just going to say, it's how I spoke earlier about, you know, formulas and game management in the Champions League and experience, and that goes back to it. You know, if Dortmund had a Pepe-like player or an experienced player that knows the game and goes, look, we're getting crosses into the box, stop the crosses, first point, or we get people in and we defend them well. And when that goal went in from the cross, and it was a fantastic header, you just saw the players, it all just kind of went, thank goodness there's not enough time, because you could probably think they would crumble. So, again, like I said, Champions League, it's a formula and you've got to have game management and you've got to have a few kind of bit of magic up your sleeve to get you through to that next round. But no question about attack, they're sensational. But I agree with Sasha, defensively, they're quite weak.
It's like in this situation here, they had Emre Can at centre-back, who gives off an idiotic penalty. Marvin Hitz in goal is just a bag of nerves all the way throughout. I think it was like a shot in the third minute, and instead of... he just kind of palms it away instead of just calmly dealing with it. So there's all this nervousness through the back four. I mean, you could see it's against like what they do in the Bundesliga, just regularly shipping loads of goals. Against Bayern, the fullbacks can't defend. All right, it is against Bayern, but elementary errors and time after time, year after year. So I think whoever is looking at the next round, yes, Holland is frightening. Yes, they're great going forward. But they'd be looking at the back line thinking, yeah, I quite fancy drawing Dortmund because they're not all that.
Do you think Liverpool would fancy Dortmund?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
What sort of club would play midfielders at centre-half, Sash? It's unbelievable, isn't it? Yeah. Unbelievable. I mean, if anyone's going to tinker with the structure of the Champions League, then surely Sevilla should be allowed to go into the Europa League now, because, you know, it's fair, isn't it? That's what they do. So.
All right. Do you want to discuss that very curious bit where time folded back on itself, courtesy of VAR? Haaland summed it up quite nicely at the end of the game, thus.
First of all, it was a nice goal before, but then it was penalty, and then I missed, and then he cheated, so then I took it again, and then I scored when he didn't cheat, so yeah, it was exact the same, but then he stood on the line, and he didn't stand on the line. But yeah, when he was screaming in my face after the first one, I was thinking, oh, it would be even better to score another goal, and yeah, that's what happened.
Anyway, it all worked out in the end. And through Dortmund go, and they'll be in the draw, as will Liverpool. Sasha, this is going to be your bit to talk about Liverpool, but when the game kicked off, what did you do?
I was doing anything but watching the game. I switched everything off. I stared at the wall for a bit. As you alluded to, I took the bins out, cleaned the kitchen, and bang, on 10 o'clock, I switched everything back on and saw that Liverpool were through so I could watch the game. And
you were that
reason
worried?
For that,
you were that worried that they would
I think it's a huge game. Yeah, it was just like this was a game where they absolutely could not make any mistakes in. Given the recent form, even, you know, allowing for Leipzig's setup and the two-goal lead, I wasn't completely confident. And I think if Liverpool went out at this stage like they did last season, you know, this time it would be psychologically absolutely disastrous. I also was thinking, let's say a year ago when they played Atletico, of course the game that should never have been played, but feels now like the last game of like Il Grande Liverpool, if you like, you know, full Anfield, Liverpool going at Atletico Madrid, superb game until Adrian error, the missed kick, and that stopped something. And maybe this is the chance of Liverpool maybe to rise up again. And I thought in this particular game, the approach was perfect. Fabinho in midfield, of course, everyone's commented on it, but you could see how they were defending. I mean, against, say, for example, you take Chelsea, the press was shambolic. It just wasn't existent. Here, you could see they had the front three, the three behind. It's like a screen of six.
in front of the Leipzig players when they were on the ball. I thought the back line, perhaps, it was really weird watching on telly because it focused on that part of the pitch. So couldn't really tell how deep the back line was set, but it felt like they had enough there to not be completely caught out by balls over the top, even though that happened a couple of times. But I thought just overall, Thiago, you think, yeah, he's looking better, and he did that kung fu pass forward for Salah. He's on it again with Fabinho next to him. It's a completely different proposition, and yeah, I just thought this was a complete performance, including all the missed chances until they finally scored.
Right, 70th minute when Salah opened the scoring, and then within 4 minutes Mane had added another. First time since October that Fabinho's been there in midfield.
Yes, yeah, since the Everton game, and I kind of agree with Sasha about the Atleti game being a turning point. And then I think the next turning point was that Everton game. Obviously, Van Dijk getting injured, Thiago getting injured, and everything having to change. So yeah, maybe this is the turning point.
Okay, this came at the Puskas Arena with this famous sign: "This is Puskas Arena. This means more." Karen, do you trust them to repeat this success elsewhere? When you see Thiago alongside Fabinho and Fabinho back in midfield, do you think Il Grande Liverpool is back?
No, I think they knew how to turn up for this game. You know, one-off games they're prepared for. They know, look, this is going to save their season in essence. So I think they were up for it. They rested players ahead of the game. I think there was 6 changes. So there was a freshness towards this Liverpool side. There was an energy. I think Jota as well coming in was more aggressive in the press. You know, Sasha spoke about the pressing intent. I just thought it was more like the old Liverpool. And you're right, Fabinho in there, Wijnaldum in there, they had the legs and the energy, which is what Liverpool are all about. Because, you know, I watched the clips back against Fulham and the back line were really, really high, but there was no pressure on the ball. And so they just lumped it over the top and got in. And basically you need people to press and stop that if you're going to have that high line. And that was a big difference, I thought, last night. And you need them, your energy in midfield to get around the pitch. And so I think in terms of Champions League, I think they can prepare for those games, but it'll be at a detriment at the league because they might rest players and bring people in. So, but you can't ever write them off. And key players might come back later on as the season progresses for this competition. So I don't think you can write them off, but I think they know in their heads the league's gone and Champions League places is going to be a big ask for them.
Right, but you could see them doing a run in the Champions League?
Yeah, I really do. I think they could. I think it, but they'll have to, like I said, it'll have to be at detriment at some times in the league. They might do what they did against Fulham and rest players.
As you say, Karen, it was only about 5 days before this that Liverpool had probably their worst game of the season, losing at home to Fulham. They've got Wolves, a visit to Molineux on Monday. How does that fit in with this defenders leaving them space and all that paradigm?
Well, we know about Wolves, they come alive in the second half. And I agree with Sasha, I think they'll be defensively organised. They defend with a back five at times. So it's, again, going to be difficult for Liverpool to break down. Also, the quick turnaround for Liverpool to recover and go again. I think they'll grind out a result, Liverpool, but I think it'll be very difficult. And again, Liverpool have to be very mindful of how strong Wolves do come into the latter part of the game. And they've done well over the last, you know, 6 weeks. Wolves, not playing particularly well, but grinding out results. And that's something they could pose as a threat towards Liverpool in the game.
Will you be watching this one, Sasha, or will you be switching everything off and staring at the wall?
You know, taking the bins out.
Yeah, taking the bins out. No, I'll watch this one because there's nothing riding on this particular one. And also, I think what comes after Wolves, Liverpool have 3 weeks off. This is the period where they can actually prepare for the final stage of the season. Finally, Klopp gets a period where he can train his team because obviously so far he just doesn't have the time. They're recovering all the time. So he will have some players back. Maybe Henderson might get closer. And obviously with Jota in, they can reintegrate in how they play. Fabinho in midfield, work on those new defenders. So I think they can really prepare properly for the last 2 months. Again, perhaps in terms of energy this season, because of how it panned out, Liverpool cannot play like they play against Leipzig every single game. But this is because they have Europe. This is where we can pay. Perhaps they can pace themselves and switch it on in Europe, maybe for a couple of games in the league to make sure that, you know, it's not completely like up and down all the time. But I think this is crucial, and this is another reason why Liverpool had to get through, because they actually have a, I think, genuine chance of making this push because of this 3 weeks off.
So Raphael Honigstein was making the point on Tuesday that it was a similar break that enabled Klopp to turn things around in that similarly disastrous final season at Borussia Dortmund. So that's really interesting. But why 3 weeks off? The FA Cup will be one of the reasons.
Yeah, and an international break. And we'll see how many people can travel. But the South Americans obviously aren't going. Yeah. And let's see what happens to the European games. But I think, again, for the South Americans, it's key because Firmino's got an injury. Fabinho's just recovered. You know, Alisson, I mean, we'll see what happens with Alisson because obviously of his dad as well, but whether he stays or whether he goes. So I think at least the core of the players stay. I'm not sure what happens to Salah and Mane at the moment, whether they'll be traveling or not. Of course, I'd prefer none of them to travel because it feels really odd to have lots of traveling in this particular time of the year, given the COVID situation. But there is genuinely, I think, there is a possibility that he will have a core of his team to work on stuff.
You know what though, Sasha? I'd be surprised if he does want to work with him. I'm not saying he would send them on international duty. I think he would give them time off. If I was him, I'd get away from the training ground. As a player, when things aren't going great and it's been a really difficult period, sometimes stepping away and having a break from everyone, and even Klopp himself, because he's been through a lot personally, you know, step away. You know, less is more. They're not going to lose fitness. They're not going to... Of course, the injured players have got to go in and push back. But I think take yourself away from a training ground, because it's a really difficult place, a training ground, when things aren't going well and the mood and the energy. So sometimes to get that, have a little bit of a respite. So I think less is more. And I wouldn't be surprised if Klopp went, look, have 5 days off and I don't want to see you and I don't want you anywhere near the training ground. Go be with, you know, your families that you can be in a COVID situation. When we come back in, we grind and we go for it. And you're right, we go hard and we go for this Champions League.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Positive thoughts there for Liverpool fans. All right, next up, we'll be turning our thoughts to the Women's Champions League action midweek and also the Premier League weekend.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Last 16 taking shape in the Women's Champions League. Chelsea are through, Karen, against Atletico Madrid. Thanks to that 10-woman win last week, really. This was a 1-1 draw this week.
Yeah, I mean, I watched the game, the 1-1 draw, and it was, again, fine margins. You know, Atletico should have probably had 3 penalties. 2 of them were denied, and one was given. And it was an opportunity for them to get back in the game and they hit the crossbar. Chelsea went the other end, had a penalty and scored it, and that was a tie over. So it was a real close-knit game. I don't think Emma Hayes was particularly pleased in terms of the performance, but they got the result. And like I keep saying, this competition is a results-orientated business. Doesn't matter, no one cares how you get through. Just get through into the next round. So she'll be pleased with that. It's been a taxing week. And as you said, they were down to 10 players in the first leg. So to get through, she would have been pleased with that.
All right. Barcelona also through. Chelsea, Lyon, Bayern, Rosengarten, Wolfsburg also in the quarterfinals. Paris Saint-Germain and Man City should be joining them on this Thursday. Who's going to lose to Lyon in the final this year, do you think, Karen?
It's tough. I think City and Chelsea are really going to be up for it. I really know that they're both. Man City are really coming into form. They bought a lot of players. A new manager came in and they're really starting to click into gear, and I think they could cause them problems. Chelsea, I think, could be a real threat. I think they're probably one of the best counter-attacking teams in European football at the moment, but Lyon have just got away, and that's it's that mentality. And if you can shift that mentality of not having that fear factor, I think other teams have got a chance. But they're probably the three for me who I'd say have got a very, very good chance.
Karen, I have a question. Have you played against Lyon?
Her last game.
How what are they like? Because obviously I watch Lyon year after year, and you got like Wendy Renard at the back, who's just like a colossus, and quality players absolutely everywhere. How do you play against them? Because their record speaks for itself. It's absolutely frightening. They look like they're frightening to play against. So how do you approach a game against Lyon?
It's not to have fear. We played them in the Champions League semi-final, and I think we lost 2-1 at their place and we drew 1-1 at ours. And if the team hadn't have had that fear factor in the first 45 minutes where we were naive, and like I said, formulas about Champions League, we conceded a minute before half-time, we conceded on a set play. I don't think there was team to be fearful as everyone presumes. So it's that similar thing probably when Arsenal had it. As soon as you walked on the pitch, you think, oh, we've lost the game. You can't have that attitude because it gives the advantage. And I think if Chelsea at the time when I was playing there, we'd had that mentality of who cares, I think it would have given us even more of an edge. And we only realised that we were close to them when the tie was done. We got them to our place and it was 1-1 and we hit the post, etc. I think then it was a shift in mentality. We were like, we're actually getting close to them. But they are difficult. But like I said, they've lost players in key positions and other teams are strengthened. So I don't think they're the force they were, but they've got that winning knack and that game understanding of how to get results in this competition, which sometimes you can't buy.
Excellent. Okay, well, the draw for the quarterfinals is coming up Friday. So it'll be interesting to see who gets who. Next up, let's hit the Premier League weekend.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Right, what awaits in the Premier League as we hit the 10 games to go mark? City, who are now 14 points clear again after Wednesday evening's 5-2 win against Saints, visit Fulham, who are now just goal difference from safety. Their closest rivals, Brighton, visit Saints. Newcastle are only a point better off than the Cottagers, host Villa on Friday evening. Elsewhere, the battle for top four spots sees Chelsea at Leeds. Chelsea, who are now fourth after Monday's victory over Everton. Third place Leicester take on Sheffield United in the Foxes against the Fox Classico. Everton are up against Burnley, and two huge games on the Sunday evening, the North London Derby and Man United against David Moyes' West Ham. Woof, Monday's mentioned it's Wolves Liverpool. Right, North London Derby, everybody. Arsenal against Tottenham, it's Sunday, 4:30. How worried should Arsenal fans be?
I think they've got bigger issues to worry about, really. They've got this Europa League game first to concern with, and I think he's got to pick the right team for the game against Olympiacos, and then I think then he's got to turn his attention quickly to the North London Derby. But for me, the North London Derby is actually, of course, it's about egos and pride for the fans and for the club, but it actually is secondary at the moment. The Europa League is the main competition, and it literally has got to keep their season alive for Arsenal. So their focus has got to be primarily on that at the moment, I think.
Spurs will also be involved in Thursday night action. They'll be at home, though, to Dinamo Zagreb, whereas Arsenal are off in Piraeus again.
Tottenham haven't won three league games in a row against Arsenal since the Rubik's Cube was invented, and I think whichever manager can rotate better after the Europa League might be in with a chance of winning this game. But I mean, I think the big question is obviously Gareth Bale. He's been brilliant the last couple of weeks, and you know, he's got five goals against Arsenal in the Premier League, more than he has against any other team. He did used to be a bit of a bane for them. So if he can continue this, I think it's pretty worrying for Arsenal, because that kind of attack of Son, Kane, Bale not only is a series of one syllable names, but you know, really good, effective forward. So yeah, right. We'll see.
And Kane with a terrific record, obviously, in this fixture as well. Spurs in all competitions, four straight victories in which they've scored 12 and only conceded 2. Jose Mourinho hasn't always adopted a free-flowing attacking approach in big games. But even though Arsene Wenger's not there, I've always got the impression that Jose absolutely loathes Arsenal and might really enjoy putting them to the torch in this one.
Yeah, I remember being at Stamford Bridge for Arsene Wenger's 1,000th game in charge of Arsenal. Mourinho back in his second spell at Chelsea, and they won 6-0. And it's fair to say he revelled in that. And yeah, I mean, he obviously had a lot of history with Arsenal in the Wenger era. You know, and I even remember the first time he didn't win the league, Chelsea were playing at the Emirates, and he did that walking across the pitch doing his keep your chin up gesture to the Chelsea fans. And yeah, he'll be up for this. And, you know, everyone knows that big games this season have tended to be mostly 0-0, but Arsenal-Tottenham is generally the kind of big six game that is a bit more anarchic, and, you know, it tends to end in some sort of huge drama. So I wouldn't be surprised to see quite a few goals in this game.
Yeah, I don't think it will be 0-0. I mean, even everyone's criticised Spurs for being defensive, scored over, you know, 100 goals this season. So, and that front four, and Spurs have to attack because of their defence. It's so vulnerable. The best form of defence is attack, and they've literally got to go for it. And we've seen how Arsenal play out. It's risk versus reward. They'll be thinking the same, but I agree with Duncan. I think there'll be goals in it, and I think it'll be an entertaining derby.
Spurs coming off a 4-1 victory over Palace. Arsenal from a 1-1 draw with Burnley. Sasha, can you make the case for the Gunners?
I think the case for the Gunners will be there is really, I don't think there is much pressure on them in this game because they're so far adrift. Whereas I think Spurs are still, you know, they're looking at getting into top four. There is still pressure on Spurs' results in the league, where I don't think there is this pressure on Arsenal. And therefore, maybe Arteta can try something a little bit different just to see how Spurs would react to that. So I think probably Arsenal should be approaching this with a much calmer demeanour, sort of none of the Arsenal fan TV craziness. I think they should just treat it as another game.
Okay, and maybe the lack of fans at the Emirates might help them out in that. Spurs, as you say, still questing for the top four. They're 5 points off the Champions League positions, lying seventh. 3 points ahead of them in fifth are West Ham, who are, in a fixture which comes with a big tub of narrative, at Man United. David Moyes, formerly the chosen one, back at Old Trafford. He's never won there as a visiting manager. Of course, he didn't win that much in the other dugout either. Is it time to reevaluate that season at Old Trafford when he got the job and made Jose cry? Was it all his fault or given... Was it... No, Duncan says no.
It wasn't his fault, but I think the way he played at Everton, he hasn't really been able to get a team to play like that until now at West Ham. And I don't think if he'd have tried to do that at United, I think the fans wouldn't have really stood for it. You know, they were the reigning league champions when he took over. You know, they wanted a certain style of football, and he did try and provide that, and it didn't work. But, you know, West Ham are looking so good. They win against Leeds on Monday was, you know, dominant, calm, no real issues. And he's getting performances out of really kind of, you know, not yeoman footballers, but like Craig Dawson has suddenly turned into a goal threat. He scored more goals in 2021 than Marcus Rashford, which is, you know, a thing. And I can see West Ham doing okay in this game. Yeah,
I think what's really impressive with West Ham is the winter signings. I mean, obviously last year you had Soucek and Bowen. This time you have Jaylinks. And they've really they came into the team quickly, organically, and are able to produce the results straight away. I mean, of course, missing Lingard in this game could be a bit of a problem, but they can perhaps be slightly more conservative like they were before. But I think him coming in is certainly, you know, added a bit of warmth to how they play. I mean, I saw West Ham play against Liverpool, and I thought there was a bit of old Moyes in that they were quite, they weren't positive enough, I didn't think, in that game. So let's see how he approaches this one.
I don't think they've been, this is going to be a bit harsh, I don't think they've been ultra positive the whole season. They've actually enjoyed defending, and they've got counter-attacking players like your Jesse Lingards, like your Bowens, like your Antonios, who are quite happy that they sit back, they defend, they wait for you to make mistakes, and they absolutely counter on you in pace. And we know that teams that don't have a lot of possession are getting the results at the moment. And I think defensively really, really organised, and they're just, he's brought in players that are sensational on the counter-attack, like Jesse Lingard. How he hasn't played for a year and he's got the levels of fitness that he has. I saw him live, I think, after the second game in, and I couldn't believe how fit and how dominant he was up and down the pitch. And that's a credit to him. They've got the structure behind them. So I don't think I think the fans not being there is helpful, because they're not going to outplay you. Of course they can play, but their game plan is solely counter-attacking football, and it's working wonders.
Also, talking of the style of football, Karen, when you were at the club and a manager comes in from slightly lower level, perhaps making a step up and, you know, he tries to introduce maybe his brand of football. Do the better players, how do they react?
It can be very restrictive because you're coming into a winning side and why are you changing that? We've just won the league. And also it's a bit, I thought it was always a poison chalice. Why, you know, you'd never turn Man United down, and that's a difficult one, but do you really want to go in and be that first person after Sir Alex Ferguson, after doing all that, and make change, and the players are restrictive, they probably don't buy into the manager just because it's not Sir Alex? It's so hard.
Well, exactly, and also the only player he got to bring in that summer was Fellaini, who came from his old club and kind of embodied the old way that he used to play, so that just kind of made it worse. And then, obviously, in January, Juan Mata arrived on a helicopter, but that didn't really help much either. So, right. Yeah, I think, like Karen says, anyone could have gone in after Ferguson and really made a success of it. But, you know, Moyes probably did deserve a chance at a club that big, but that wasn't the one.
All right, maybe West Ham will be that big club. It was a difficult time, Ferguson stepping aside, David Gill leaving as well. She had Moyes arriving with Ed Woodward, and we all know how that turned out. Anyway, is this the time? Is this the time that he gets his first win away at Old Trafford? They are unbeaten, Man United, in 11 matches in all competitions, ahead of Thursday evening's game, which might be underway by the time you hear this, listener, in which they're hosting Milan in the Europa League. Quick prediction, West Ham, Man United, what do you think? Sash?
Draw.
Draw.
1-1.
Duncan?
No.
Karen?
I'm going Man United win.
There you go. Excellent. Next up. Ooh, Leeds-Chelsea and the big battle at the bottom.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Lunchtime Saturday, it's Leeds against Chelsea. Monday evening, Chelsea were in action, beating Everton 2-0. Leeds were also playing and losing by that same scoreline to West Ham. Leeds have, in fact, now lost four of their last five. Chelsea, as it stands, are they going to be challengers for the title next season? Is there anything they're missing?
Goal scorer. You know, I was at that game that you mentioned against Everton, and they pass the ball like it's 10 passes as a goal. They really do. They just pass, and they just drain you out. But, you know, the first goal was an own goal, and then the second goal was a set play. Look, they're getting the results, and clean sheets have been really, really good, and they look completely in control. But again, it's just who's that one person that's going to put the ball in the back of net consistently? You know, Timo Werner had lots of chances, and again, the same outcome. Played Kai Havertz up there, who actually was brilliant. He was really, really good. Really enjoyed him in that role. Very, very smart. I know he played up there for Leverkusen towards the end of his time there and was very effective. But you just need a goal scorer, and I don't see it in Werner. And he looks frustrated, and I don't know where his best position is. And I think that's their Achilles heel at the moment. And maybe one midfielder, but I still think they're a little bit off.
So far, under Tuchel, they've conceded 0.22 goals per game, which if you extrapolate over a 38-game season is about 8.4 goals. So let's round it down to 8. That would shatter the current Chelsea record of 15 in 04-05. So, I mean, obviously that's not going to continue, you know, in perpetuity, but the transformation in their defence since he took over is, you know, if you ever want to demonstrate to someone how a new manager can come in and with the same players essentially, you know, completely change the way they play and how they defend, then this is one of the best examples ever.
Yeah, in his 11 matches in charge so far, only one opposition player, Minamino, has found the back of the Chelsea net. He's unbeaten in his first 9 Premier League matches. Only 2 managers have begun their Premier League careers with longer unbeaten runs. Listener, can you name them? Go on, Duncan.
It's Maurizio Sarri, beloved at Chelsea. And perhaps more surprisingly, Frank Clark of the old Nottingham Forest days.
Wow. And they finished third.
Alrighty.
One thing I would add on Chelsea as well, I think it's a good time to find defensive competence. And I think if you look at their next 5 games, should probably be able to win them all, and that will probably clinch Champions League for them. Wow. So, effective. Mm.
This game, they've certainly got a good record in. Last time Leeds beat Chelsea was December 2002. It was a 2-0 victory at Elland Road. El Tell was in charge back then. It's a game that featured Jonathan Woodgate and a 16-year-old James Milner on the score sheet. He looked identical back then to what he does now.
You know what, though? With this game, a lot of teams haven't pressed Chelsea and they've allowed them to get into this rhythm. This is a challenge for me because Leeds will press you. And this is, I think this is a really interesting fixture. I think Leeds could get a result out of this because everyone else has kind of not pressed Chelsea. They've backed off. This team's going to go after them and it'll be interesting to see how they react and how Thomas Tuchel manages this game. So I'm really excited and going to look very closely at this game.
Interesting. All right, now also in the top four race, Everton kind of, they're 4 points off the Champions League places, but with a game in hand over Chelsea. Saturday evening, or 5:30, they'll be hosting Burnley, while the next day, Sunday at 2 o'clock, it's Leicester against Sheffield United, who haven't won any of the last 10 meetings with the Foxes. Meanwhile, at the bottom, West Brom, who are in 19th place, are at Palace. That'll be the third game in a row that Sam Allardyce is up against one of his former clubs, curiously. Fulham, who are now level on points with Brighton, host Man City, and Brighton visits Saints. Do you want to talk about Parker Toney and whether he, a week after that Liverpool win, could spring the ultimate surprise against Pep Guardiola, Sash?
Probably not, but I think it's a free hit for him because he had... So obviously they went through a spell where they were playing well and couldn't win a game. Then they picked up some wins in February. Then they're coming up to the spell of games against Spurs, Liverpool and Man City. And maybe the best he can hope for is 3 points. They got the 3 points against Liverpool, which I think, again, like, because I went to the first game when they first played Liverpool at Craven Cottage. And that was about two or three games after he switched the system. And there were similarities between that game and this game against Liverpool. It's the way they went at Liverpool in the first half, except this time they did it much more aggressively, much more confidently. And then second half, more defending, obviously the Cordoveri dropping in as the fifth defender. And it just looks like a much better honed system. But I'm not sure whether they will be able to kind of go at Man City as effectively as they have done against a team that's as low on confidence as Liverpool, because I think basically Manchester City, I think, have the players to play through this. But I don't think this is a game where they need to achieve anything. I think they should be able to do better than they traditionally do against City, because I think, you know, City find it easy to play against certain teams. And over the years, I think Fulham, they just basically generally spanked them. And I remember when Parker faced Man City 2 years ago when they were getting relegated. The game was over in 3 minutes. I don't think it's going to be over in 3 minutes now. And I think Parker can probably just enjoy this one because, I mean, he's beaten Klopp, he's beaten Ancelotti, he's beaten, I think, on a personal level, he must like quite enjoy this. He's beaten really experienced, established managers. And I think the game against Guardiola would just be interesting for him. And I think, you know, they were talking on Match of the Day 2 after the Liverpool game, and Danny Murphy was talking a lot about, you know, the mentality, the approach. But I think more credit has to be given to Parker for switching to defensive system, not just mentally, but, you know, physically on the pitch. The implementation, I think first and foremost, this system is about defence. I mean, if I look at the results, maybe this is one of the reasons why they kind of struggle to pick up points against the teams right above them. There's a bunch of draws, and they have a few of those games coming up, which they need to win. But perhaps there's less pressure now because they've kind of caught up. So I think Parker can just enjoy this one. And I think the big one for him is Leeds next week.
If Fulham do play as well as they have been, maybe City's best chance of scoring will be Phil Foden winning a well-earned penalty.
You're making an ironic reference to the fact that he was denied a Stonewall spot kick because he didn't go down.
Yeah, he stayed up too easy. Yeah, it was a very strange incident. I mean, we try not to go on about VAR too much, but this surely was why it was brought in, because, yeah, maybe John Moss didn't see it and maybe he thought that Alex McCarthy got a touch, but he clearly didn't, and why was it not overturned? I always thought McCarthyism was about indiscriminate allegations on the basis of unsubstantiated charges, but that wasn't the case here, so poor.
The turnaround, though, as you say, from the start of the season when they were comfortably on track to break the kind of conceding 80 goals in the season mark to the run of clean sheets they've had of late is remarkable.
One thing I would add, though, you look at the team that faced Liverpool, I think there was 10 or 11 new players in there, but six of them loanees. So, I mean, he loaned in Areola, Anderson, Aina, Lookman, Lemina, Maja. So how many of them, and also Loftus-Cheek, I mean, how many of them will he be able to keep? On the one hand, got new lads coming in and they get the system and they obviously know how to play it really quickly. On the other hand, how much longer term can he build on this? Which I think would be the challenge in the summer. How many of these players he can keep? Some of them, I mean, I don't think he'll be able to keep Lookman, for example. But then also, you know, he added Maja because I think he realised he needs more goals up there. So against Liverpool and against Spurs, he almost played with two up top, which is brave, but again it shows the confidence in the team, and they won one of those games and just conceded one goal in the other.
What he will have, he'll have time, and what he didn't have when he got promoted because of the playoff and because of the quick turnaround, he'll have time to assess the situation. He'll know where the club's at, whether they're in the Premier League or not. And I think the reason why they started so poorly was because they didn't have time to prepare. He didn't have time to get those players in. Now he's got his fixed team. Anderson's been a revelation. And you're right, those loanees that have come in, he can train with them and work with them, and he's gone a little bit more pragmatic. But I think even though he knows he's got those on loan, he will have the time to prepare, similar to how Aston Villa did last season when they came up. It was a shopping dash. They got it fixed. And now look at them. So if he gets the same time to sort it out, that, you know, that will be a real big advantage for him going into the next season.
Speaking of Aston Villa, Friday night they're going to be at one of the other teams directly involved in this scrap, Newcastle. Newcastle are only a point better off than Brighton and Fulham. One win in six. Villa haven't actually won at St James's Park since April 2005. Duncan, do you remember this game?
I do, yeah. It was the one when Lee Bowyer and Kieran Dyer ended up fighting and getting sent off.
Teammates.
Yeah, teammates. I mean, you know, that was a very dysfunctional, internally problematic Newcastle. So
totally unlike.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's one of the great, great moments of Premier League history, really.
So there's rumours of, and, you know, we have to tread carefully with rumours, but they seem to be quite substantiated reports of a lot of friction within the Magpies camp at the moment. Steve Bruce has, I think, referenced this as well. I mean, Karen, on one hand, this is the kind of stuff that pros always say this happens all the time and you probably want that passion, etc. But of all the three teams, are they the one you're most worried about, Newcastle?
Yes, I am. I was at the game against West Brom and, it was a very dry 90 minutes, to say the least. But yeah, I'm worried because the goals, you know, all the teams down there are struggling, but I think Fulham have got a bit momentum. I think West Brom are a bit more, I don't know, they've got a bit more dogged. Newcastle, it's just a dire situation for them. And the goals, you know, you're looking at Joel Linton scored one goal this season. Fraser's been in and out and he's playing up top. Gale and Carroll are out of contract. Who's really going to fight and play for the manager? And I think it's just a massive issue in terms of who's going to get in the goals. And I just, from the performance, I didn't really see it. And against West Brom, he went attacking quite early as opposed to West Brom, who needed the result more than Newcastle. Still didn't really do anything. They were disappointing. So, yeah, I really do fear for Newcastle. And Brighton, though, you know, the goals as well. Just play nice football, but it's results-orientated business and you're not getting the results.
I mean, this Newcastle game does remind us that Steve Bruce is a rare manager in that he's managed Newcastle and Sunderland, Aston Villa and Birmingham, and both Sheffield clubs. So, you know, he's been around, and I don't know, that doesn't sit right with a lot of fans of those teams, and generally, I think
he's still behind Sam Allardyce, who's managed even more Premier League clubs than him.
Well, yeah, but Allardyce is more of a kind of an overall spread rather than kind of, you know, direct rivals.
Okay, then. Steve Bruce has managed five Premier League clubs, just in case you're keeping track, listener. Mark Hughes is on six. Allardyce with a whopping eight. Crikey. It says here, Roy Hodgson's done five. So that's what? Liverpool, Palace, West Brom.
Blackburn.
Who am
Fulham.
I missing?
Fulham.
Of course, Fulham. All right, then. Let's get some odds and more with a brand new voice here on the Totally Football Show. As Lee Price heads off to new challenges, a new edge of reality monologues. Here is Carl Monaghan from Paddy Power.
Thank you, James, and hello to all the football-adoring listeners out there. I must say I'm a regular listener, and right now I'm talking to myself. With some intriguing managerial jousts in store, we'll get right into it. Bielsa and Tuchel dance at first light on Saturday, a contrast of footballing styles, but both enjoy a snug tracksuit. Neutrals and pundits seem to back Bielsa's men blind, and they'll have their takers this week at 7-2. The Leeds fans must be well familiar by now with the feelings of nausea and ecstasy that one usually associates with a trip to Alton Towers. The West Yorkshiremen have lost 5 of their last 7, while Tuchel's well-oiled work in progress are unbeaten in 11. The 8-11 about Chelsea here is sure to appeal to some. Despite a vacant Emirates this Sunday, Spurs will go there in full voice. Bale has the boyish grin back and the fire in his eyes looks relit. Has the Welshman saved Jose's behind from the bacon slicer? Spurs to claim the North London bragging rights is 17-10, and with Louise and Co set to be put through their paces, an away win looks tempting. Later on Sunday, we see Moyes go back to Old Trafford. The poisoned chalice that was replacing Fergie still looms largely over the Scot. You can expect West Ham to land a glove as confidence is high, though. One Victor Lindelof may be quaking in his boots when he sees what Antonio benches. Bruno and Shaw are sure to be a nuisance, and with Jesse Lingard's loan deal leaving him covered in red tape, United may edge it. A home win and both teams to score looks the shrewd way to play it at 13-5.
Thank you, Carl. You can find out those odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. A listener, if you're hungry for a subscription to The Athletic and its unrivaled coverage on the business end of the season, then why not head to theathletic.com/totally. You get all the articles, all the podcasts ad-free and Q&As with writers, all for just £4 a month, crikey. Karen, we've got a podcast series called Golazzo, and this Friday we're dropping a new one all about Ronaldo. No, not that one, that one. He's one of your idols, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, yeah. He was my first football boot that I had, and I think I've told you before, I've got all my Brazil kits, my favourite jerseys, but yeah, my silver R9s with the blue tick were, I loved him. He was so good. I think it's just growing up watching him in the World Cup and that team, Ronaldo, Rivaldo, Carlos, just, I think that was probably a massive reason why I fell in love with football, just watching them. And yeah, but Ronaldo was massive. And like I said, I needed those Nike boots. I wanted them, and fair play to my mum and dad. They found a way and got me a pair. So
nice one.
Yeah, massive, massive fan.
Excellent. All right. Well, you might enjoy our reflection specifically on his Inter years and the bits around that. And it's lovely to see that he's a very happy man now by the looks of it. Yeah.
Are you paying homage to his goal against Spartak Moscow on a non-pitch in 1998?
Yes. That gets a mention. That does get a mention.
Brilliant, brilliant skill on a pitch with no grass. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Now, England women news this week. Confirmation that Hege Riise will take charge of Team GB at this summer's Tokyo Olympics as and when that occurs.
Yeah, it's been announced. I think it's, a smart... She's won the Olympics herself in 2000, so she's very accustomed to the competition, knows what it means and what it takes. So I think it's smart. I think she's kind of a neutral manager that can look over and yes, she is at the moment in charge of England temporarily, but I think she can sit back and pick the best squad needed for this competition. It is different because looking at it personally, I'm thinking you might not pick your best footballers and you might sit back and go, what? But you're only able to take a really, really small squad. So you might just take your most athletic 18 players actually, because the quick turnaround, you can't carry players, so it's quite a strategic team that she'll have to pick. But I'm sure she's got really good advice and she knows all the nations that she can pick from. It'll be interesting who she takes,
because you played in the Olympics in 2012, and you're just saying about how you grew up with a Brazil kit and that you set up Steph Horton's goal in the 1-0 win over Brazil. No,
Karen Carney gives chase. Lovely sidestep to get out of the hole there. And in towards Steph Horton. She couldn't score again, could she? Yes, she could! This is incredible!
Was that one of your all-time kind of career highlights?
Yeah, I think it is, to be honest. I think because I've said it many a times, it's every boy's dream to play at Wembley, but we got to play at Wembley, you know, nearly 80,000 people there, when so many people told us, there's no interest in women's football, you'll never get a crowd. And we did it in 2012 and everyone loved it. And, to beat Brazil, it's really weird because I think in the space of like a month or two, I'd played for England. There was quite a negative perception around it. And then I put my Great Britain kit on and everyone was all over us. Like, it was like we were the celebrities everywhere. And it was just like there was so much joy and passion around the 2012 team. It was just amazing. And we beat Brazil. And then it was my birthday. So because it was a late kickoff, I was on the bus and it turned like midnight and everyone sung me happy birthday. And I remember having my birthday in the Olympic Village, beating Brazil, playing in front of 80,000 people. I was like, I don't think you'll ever top that. And there's photos of like my family have took of how high up they were, like in the, like literally in the gods. And it was just like, you'd never known that that was me playing in that game, and or it was either a male or a female game. It was, it just looked like a full packed stadium watching people play. So it was just a brilliant experience. And like I said, it'll whoever goes will have the best time of their life, because it is, to be an Olympian, it is you take that very, very seriously. And you're I think you get a dog tag when you go. So when you first get in, they give you a dog tag and you got a number on it. And I think I was like 364 out of 515 that represented Great Britain out of 70-80 million. So, you know, that stat is ridiculous. So whoever goes, whoever Hegarisa picks from all four nations that you can go by, it will be an amazing experience.
Brilliant. All right. Well, unlikely to be crowds of 80,000 at the games there, or indeed any crowds, sadly. But we'll see. A lot of question marks still surrounding the Tokyo Olympics, but it does seem set to be occurring this summer. That brings us to the end of today's Totally Football show. Of course, we will return on Monday morning to review the weekend's activities and look ahead to another packed midweek of Champions League and Europa League action next time around. But for now, it's many thanks to Karen, to Duncan, and to Sasha, and producer Charlie, and you, listener. Have a great weekend, and we'll catch you on the other side.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on The Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.